Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Relief teams have arrived in Haiti, and the cleanup begins.
We spent the day picking up dead bodies all day. That's what we did, from kids. It's so much bodies in the streets that the morgues have filled up, the cemeteries have filled up.
Haitian singer Wyclef Jean was rattled, but was returning to the streets of Port-au-Prince today. Like so many others, he's swallowing his personal grief as he works to help his nation. The mission in Haiti, for thousands of aid workers, help the living, bury the dead. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Friday, January 15th, and The Takeaway for me is, when there are so many urgent needs, how do you make a triage if you are an aid worker in Haiti?
It's definitely the job that's beginning in Port-au-Prince and in the areas devastated by the earthquake. And let's get right to the top story that we're following this morning. That situation in Port-au-Prince is growing more desperate by the hour. Crippled ports and communications has left stunned earthquake survivors on their own to scavenge for food and water, to carry away the legions of the dead, and to dig frantically for voices still calling out from under the rubble.
This is just running down my eyes because of family, friends, and I mean, even though people I don't know, I just feel sorry for them.
Yesterday, it was estimated that 7,000 people were buried in a mass grave. The Red Cross estimates the death toll will eventually rise to 50,000. And after another night spent on the streets, many are making their way into the countryside.
People are leaving Port-au-Prince in masses.
The president had this message, President Obama, that is.
More American search and rescue teams are coming. More food, more water, doctors, nurses, paramedics, more of the people, equipment, and capabilities that can make the difference between life and death.
He called it one of the largest relief efforts in history, $100 million in initial aid.
We spoke earlier to Rear Admiral Victor Guillory. He's the commander of Naval Forces of the Southern Command and responsible for all U.S. Navy operations in the relief effort. He told us the relief effort is improving rapidly, and he expects real progress in the coming hours.
We have more helicopters in theater, and the coordination is getting better. Communications is being improved with the various agencies and the government of Haiti.
For more on the situation, we were joined by Ansel Hertz earlier today. He's a freelance journalist in Port-au-Prince. Good morning, Ansel.
Good morning.
Are you seeing a change today from what you saw yesterday?
No, I haven't been out too much yet today, but I haven't seen changes really day-to-day since the earthquake struck. People are out in the streets. There's not a massive amount of relief getting to them. I've really seen no aid distribution at all throughout Port-au-Prince since the earthquake.
Ansel Hertz, stay with us. We're going to be back with you in just a moment to talk about the situation there. In other news, though, the White House is reportedly considering a criminal trial in Washington for the Guantanamo Bay detainee suspected of masterminding the bombing of a Bali nightclub that killed 202 people. And there's word that as many as 8 U.S. Army officers could be disciplined for not responding properly to the erratic behavior of the Fort Hood shooting suspect. The Pentagon is releasing the results of an inquiry into the shootings later today. Also, a compromise could be reached as early as today on health care reform. The White House and labor unions say they've reached an agreement on how to tax high-cost health plans. President Obama says Democrats are now on the verge of passing a historic health care bill. Looking at the markets, Asian markets are mixed. European indices are down and futures are down as well. The Dow will start at 10,710, the S&P at 1,148, and the NASDAQ opens at 2316.
One of the other big stories that we're going to focus on this Friday involves you. Conan, Leno, it's a shakeup at NBC and late night. Conan may be on the way out of NBC. They may all jump off this sinking ship at the network, but would it help you to have a monologue to complain about your bosses heard by millions?
Ladies and gentlemen, please, you keep that up and this monologue won't start till 12:05. And
that's what Conan O'Brien and Leno get to do, trash their bosses on late night television every single night. What if you had such an opportunity? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Give us your on the way out the door short exit interview monologue. Nothing abusive now. You know how to reach us.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
For more details on the situation in Haiti, we were joined earlier by Rear Admiral Victor Guillory, commander of the U.S. Navy 4th Fleet. It has jurisdiction over the Haiti rescue effort. We heard that yesterday President Obama pledged $100 million to the aid effort in Haiti, and I asked the Rear Admiral which part of that was he responsible for.
Well, good morning. As the commander of Naval Forces Southern Command, I am responsible for the naval operations that are ongoing in this relief effort, the U.S. Navy operations, and the flow of Navy assets to the area of operations. Today, the USS Carl Vinson is on station with approximately 19 helicopters to provide direct support to the vertical lift of humanitarian supplies in accordance with the priorities set by the government of Haiti and the UN to help the people in this great time of need.
We've been hearing reports from Haiti all morning about that the airport is clogged with only one runway, that there's no coordinated relief effort as supplies begin to pour in. How do you coordinate all of these different efforts coming from all these different countries?
Well, the response to this devastating earthquake from around the world has just been tremendous. And while there is right now they're working through the amount of supplies that are being delivered via the airport, I believe those issues will be resolved over the next day. Now that we have more helicopters in theater and the coordination is getting better, communications is being improved with the various agencies and the government of Haiti, and I believe you will see relief in those areas shortly.
Admiral Guillory, we've heard that the seaport there at Port-au-Prince has been severely damaged. I'm wondering if the Carl Vinson is essentially functioning as Haiti's port, that you can offload to the Vinson and then use the helicopters to get stuff on land.
Well, that's exactly right. Carl Vinson has had a tremendous amount of capability, but in this case, it performs as a sea base. Essentially, it allows for the staging of helicopters, supplies, and to be responsive to the needs ashore. So while there's a tremendous amount of effort to complete a port survey and to open the port to allow a greater amount of supplies to come across the pier to the effort, initially, much of the work will be done by air, and the helicopters will be coming, for a large part, from the Carl Vinson.
Have Haitians been coming down towards the sea line there? Have they been coming towards the American troops?
I am not on the ground. And,
you're in Florida?
Haiti, I cannot answer that question. I'm at my headquarters in Mayport, Florida.
Admiral, we've heard some gripping, tragic, heartbreaking audio of people who need medical help right now. Do you have the capability to treat Haitians on board the Vinson? I do know that there's a medical facility on the Vinson.
There are medical facilities on the Vinson, but again, we are aligning those capabilities to the needs and the priorities as set on the ground. And those priorities are based upon the government of Haiti and the Commander Joint Task Force, along with the UN. So those medical facilities will be folded in and integrated into the medical facilities already on the ground in Haiti.
What are those priorities? Are you talking about like creating a triage list of things that you need to get accomplished first?
Well, those priorities are still being developed, but of course, the immediate delivery of supplies, the distribution of those supplies to areas that where people have concentrated, the continued rescue of folks that may still be trapped. The priorities are many right now, but there's priorities are being addressed on the ground. By the folks that are there.
We're hearing from people there in Port-au-Prince that they haven't seen much change, that Port-au-Prince still looks like a war zone with people walking around dazed. And I'm wondering, what do you think might change over the weekend? By the time we return on Monday, will we see a different Haiti than we see today?
I can tell you that all efforts are being made to expedite relief to the people suffering in Haiti, and that the naval forces are arriving and tremendously large amount are flowing and will continue to over the days and weeks ahead. And that will contribute to the larger effort, the international response to Haiti. So Like you, I expect to see the impacts of that effort throughout the next hours and days.
Now, for reasons that relate to the devastation of the earthquake itself, I mean, the government of Haiti appears to be AWOL at this point. The UN has taken an extraordinary hit themselves. Perhaps this is a moment to act unilaterally.
I'm not on the ground in Haiti. I believe that the active coordination is ongoing and that, again, naval forces will fold into those priorities being set to deliver aid.
What is the challenge? What is it that slows you down in getting the aid to the people that need it right now?
There's nothing slowing us down. We have had this carrier is in an aircraft or on station less than 72 hours from the earthquake. And we have forces flowing from around the world right now, the assets that we need to help, and from everything from conducting port surveys through the help for distribution of supplies to the areas that are most devastated. So there is nothing slowing us down. The integration and coordination of what's ongoing, and again, I believe that we will see the impact of that over the days and weeks ahead.
Rear Admiral Victor Guillory, commander of the U.S. Navy 4th Fleet that has jurisdiction over the Haiti rescue effort, a busy man today. He spoke to us from Mayport, Florida.
Certainly.
Following that conversation, one listener, Kay, called in to say that this tragedy could actually be an opportunity for recovery workers and the international community to build a better Haiti.
I believe it's everyone's responsibility to help Haiti, and we should make sure that we leave them in a position that they were better off than before.
What's your take? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE or leave a comment at our website, www.mytakeofthetakeaway.org. I should say our new website.
That's right.
www.thetakeaway.org.
Admiral Guillory, very optimistic there, very can do. We'll have to check in with him next week and see how much of that material and force actually was out and having an impact.
That's right. It's 15 minutes past the hour now, though. Let's check in on the top stories.
So looking at the headlines now, we've just heard about the ongoing U.S. relief effort in Haiti, but for survivors, aid can't come fast enough. American teacher Luke Renner describes the conditions on the ground.
It's hell on earth right now, to be honest. It's just really bad here.
Dixie Bickle runs an orphanage in Haiti. We spoke with her yesterday on The Takeaway. She says many survivors are fleeing the city but don't want to leave their deceased loved ones behind.
We're seeing people on the roads carrying their dead with them, people that have died, that they're going out in the countryside to bury them.
Meanwhile, the United Nations, which had the largest loss of life in its history when the earthquake struck in Haiti, is trying to jumpstart operations after their headquarters collapsed in the quake. One UN peacekeeper describes what's happening.
Of course, the first priority right now for the mission is to put the mission back on its feet.
He says restoring the mission will allow peacekeepers to better help survivors. And we want to remind you, if you want to donate to the relief effort, you can go to our website, thetakeaway.org. Now we can move on to some other stories we're following this morning.
Our partner, the New York Times, says the U.S. is treading lightly in the wake of the Google bust-up with China over censorship and allegations of hacking. It says the Obama administration's response to the issue is frozen. Earlier on The Takeaway, Adam Siegel of the Council on Foreign Relations said the hacking against Google follows a familiar pattern.
We've seen an IP address in China, and then often there's been a connection between that IP address and one of the government agencies.
That was Adam Siegel, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. As many as 8 U.S. Army officers could be disciplined for not responding to the erratic behavior of the Fort Hood shooting suspect. The Pentagon is releasing the results of an inquiry into the shootings later today. And moving on to the skies, airline security is expected to get even tighter. That's after officials received a threat from Al-Qaeda in Yemen. Homeland Security Secretary Jen Napolitano has told travelers to allow extra time for security, especially if they're flying into the U.S. from overseas. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning.
Hey, you want that to go?
So our first news takeout begins with a Friday question. Was it a good week or a bad week? We take your nominees anytime at 8778-MY-TAKE. But this is our collaboration with The Week magazine. They have a list of who had a good week and a bad week, and they put their good week, bad week feature every Friday in the magazine. So, Celeste, the top of the week's good week is a very familiar voice.
I'm grinning today, and I'm so appreciative of the opportunity to get to work with you and the other team members here at Fox News to provide the fair and the balanced reporting and analysis that voters in this country deserve.
She's had some good weeks and some bad weeks. Last week was a good week for Sarah Palin. She was on O'Reilly and the Fox Network. She's a contributor for them, a paid contributor for them. The former governor of Alaska, though, pushed the ratings up on O'Reilly. It hit nearly the 4 million viewer mark. That's 25% up on any of the other nights.
So maybe it was also a good week for Bill O'Reilly.
And the Fox News Network.
Last week we wished happy birthday to The Simpsons.
Oh, yeah, that's a fine looking...
Oh! But that leads us to the bad news. That event was followed by a study this week showing that the more time you spend watching TV, the greater your risk of dying young, especially from heart disease, making it a bad week for couch potatoes. It's a bad week for pretty much everybody I know.
That's right.
The survey is a journal from the American Heart Association. It tracked 8,800 adults. It found that each hour spent in front of the TV increased your risk of dying from heart disease by 18%. During the six-year period of the study, 284 people that they were studying died.
Good week for Sarah Palin on TV, bad week for people watching TV.
Exactly.
All right, if you've got nominations, you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And the full Good Week, Bad Week feature is in The Week magazine on newsstands and online now.
Now we're going to move on to Washington. We've been following developments on healthcare down there with our Washington correspondent, Todd Zwillick. Todd, you were on the Capitol last night as the lawmakers, the labor leaders, and President Obama all said they reached an agreement over how to pay for healthcare. What did they come up with? Who agreed to what?
Well, this is basically, Celeste, a $60 billion concession to labor. Whoever thought that labor was on the outs and didn't have any more political clout in Washington, this ought to change their minds a little bit. We all know that labor has been very upset over this so-called excise tax of the so-called Cadillac plans. And I keep saying so-called because everybody's trying to change the language. Nobody likes to say Cadillac plans anymore. I think it offends Detroit somehow. So we call them high-cost plans now. But The threshold for taxing those used to be $23,000. If your plan is worth $23,000, they're going to tax you above that. They bumped that up to $24,000, but then exempted all collectively bargained plans until 2017. And those are union plans. So the plans that are already negotiated, not until 2017. There's no higher taxes on those. That's
but
how they're doing this.
Is the health care bill still paid for?
It's going to have to be because the president has insisted that it will be paid for. They're going to have to find the money somewhere else. They may keep some taxes on the rich. They may ask the pharmaceutical companies for more money. That hasn't been settled yet.
Okay, and the president is out and about trying to sell the health care bill, I assume.
That's why I'll be out there waging a great campaign from one end of the country to the other, telling Americans with insurance or without insurance what they stand to gain, about the arsenal of consumer protections.
Is he going to be able to sell this?
No, who he's selling that to, Celeste, that was the Democratic caucus in the Capitol last night that he was talking to, and that sort of tepid applause there. Before he said that, he said, I know you guys are nervous. I know it's been tough. He's promising them that even though this health care bill is weak in the eyes of the public, that he will go out and sell it so that they can protect their seats if they vote for it. That's what he's promising them.
Okay, Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, thanks.
Since the first reports of that massive earthquake in Haiti, our own Takeaway correspondent Femi Okeh has been covering the angle of what are people doing in the New York area where there's a large Haitian-American community. And it's become really a center point for getting donations to Haiti and also contacting people and trying to figure out who's safe and who's been affected by this. Femi, first of all, welcome.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
And, you've had quite a week. You've met a lot of interesting people. Tell us what you've seen.
I've been to Haitian restaurants, which have become donation points. I've been to churches, Haitian churches. I've been to community centers as well, little private radio stations. Anywhere that's got Haitian in the title has become a place where people know they can come and either get advice or actually drop off goods.
So, and you've seen crowds at almost all of these places that you've been.
Nonstop. I was at the Bedford Haitian Community Center yesterday in Brooklyn. The phones didn't stop ringing and people just burst in the doors with big bags of aid that they wanted to send to Haiti.
Tell me about Martha Arce, who you met at that very facility.
Martha is actually from Puerto Rico, but she has lots of Haitian friends. And she was the first person I met yesterday morning at the Bedford Haitian Community Center.
Oh, I've been working hard gathering up all clothing for females and males and children, and sorry about what happened at Haiti. And it's really sad. I can't talk anymore. I'm sorry.
I mean, you're meeting people who are carrying devastating sort of emotional baggage as well as the effort, the literal effort to help out the people down in Haiti. Tell me about Ms. Morales at another community center you work.
Well, she was answering the phones, and she's a caseworker. She normally works with Haitian children with special needs, but suddenly she's becoming the focal point for what's happened to other people's families, trying to get the aid in. And as she was working the phone, she got some bad news herself.
This morning, I got a phone call. They told me that my auntie died in one of the hospitals in Haiti that collapsed. So she passed away. I feel bad. Everybody's calling me. Did you hear anything? Did you hear from who?
Oh, you can hear in her voice the sense of being dazed as well as working as hard as you possibly can. And we're hearing that in the voices of people in Port-au-Prince. Tell us about Mrs. Carroll, who is back at that Bedford Community Center that you visited.
I just want to leave you with something upbeat. She burst into the community center with bags of goods. Her upbeat nature just really encouraged people and helped them just lift their mood.
I'm bringing water. I'm bringing peroxide, some bandages. I'm asking for donation of Pampers from friends and other people like that. Anything that can help relieve the stress of this all on these people.
And ma'am, where are you from?
I'm Jamaican. We're a family now. It's a family thing. It could have been any country.
Well, that speaks for itself. People are really stepping up. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission continues on Capitol Hill, but the approach to regulation is really in dispute. We talk with brokerage analyst Richard Beauvais to get his perspective, and all of the commissioners will be paying attention to the top story that we're going to look at in the headlines at 31 minutes after the hour. Just breaking now, J.P. Morgan and Chase's earnings. The bank earned in the fourth quarter $3.3 billion compared with just $702 million in the previous year. Back to Haiti now, air traffic controllers have been struggling to keep earthquake aid flowing into Haiti's only airport. State Department spokesman P.J. Crowley tried to put a positive spin on the situation.
The good news is it's now operating at a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week capability, you know, but the bad news is it is a very limited airport with one runway.
A control tower was destroyed by the earthquake. At one point yesterday, 44 planes were parked on the tarmac with only two fuel trucks available. Cuba is doing its part to help speed up flights to and from Haiti. The Washington Post is reporting that Cuba has granted permission for U.S. flights to travel through restricted airspace. That will cut 90 minutes from the flight between Haiti and the U.S. Naval Station in Guantanamo Bay. For many Haitians, though, the aid can't come fast enough. We spoke earlier to Nick Davis, a BBC reporter in Port-au-Prince, who said locals are getting angry that the rescue effort isn't giving them what they need, water and food.
You can hear the aircraft taking off and landing constantly. The buzz goes throughout the day. But the response so far to many Haitians, they just don't think enough is being done fast enough.
Reports say search and rescue teams have been making some headway in the devastated Haitian capital.
A UN worker was pulled alive from the rubble of the UN headquarters yesterday, and an Icelandic search team saved a woman who was buried for 50 hours in the ruins of a market. The U.S. ambassador to Haiti says his embassy is doing its best, but has no way to check on the 40,000 or more Americans who were estimated to be in the country when the quake struck. About 450 Americans have been evacuated so far. Here at home, a compromise could be reached as early as today on the health care bill. The White House and labor unions say they've reached an agreement on how to tax high-cost health plans. The proposed changes would reduce the amount of tax revenue by 40%. Checking in on the markets, the Dow is down about 21 points. The S&P also down about 1 point, and the NASDAQ up about 4. That's a look at some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
So as we mentioned, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission convened this week to take a look at what caused the financial meltdown. And Elizabeth Warren, who heads the oversight panel, the congressional oversight panel for the current bank bailout, which was put in place in response to the financial meltdown, talked with us yesterday and said that to really think about regulating the economic system in the wake of this catastrophe, we need to go back to the 1930s, she said.
The folks who were in government at that point said, you know, we can do better than this. We can put some regulation in place. And we put three basic regulations in place: FDIC insurance to make it safe to put money in banks, Glass-Steagall to say that the banks that take deposits cannot engage in risky trading, and SEC regulations to try to make that market a little more honest. And it served us for more than 50 years. We didn't have a single financial crisis in 50 years. And then what happened? we started deregulating.
That's Elizabeth Warren yesterday on The Takeaway. She heads the Congressional Oversight Committee for the bank bailout. We wanted to put that question directly to Richard Beauvais, who's an analyst with Rockdale Securities, a brokerage firm in Stamford, Connecticut. So, Richard Beauvais, good morning.
Good morning.
Should we go back to Glass-Steagall, basically get the investment banks and the regular commercial banks separate again? They can't do the same things. You can't risk that kind of depositor money in the same way. Go back to the 1930s? Is Elizabeth Warren right here?
I mean, it's already happening. I think that, we don't need legislation passed by the Congress to reinsert Glass-Steagall into the laws. What the regulators are doing and what Congress is mandating is that you change the risk weighting on the assets held by banks. And in doing so, what they do is make it uneconomic for the banks to hold highly, risky assets, and it gives them benefits if they hold plain vanilla assets. So without passing any specific law saying that Glass-Steagall has been reimposed on the industry, Glass-Steagall is being reimposed on the industry.
But if you can hold those assets for a matter of nanoseconds using computer program trading and unloading them in complicated derivatives, can you really enforce a regulation like that?
Well, certainly. I mean, one of the biggest problems, and I think your quote from Ms. Warren indicated this, was that we decided not to use the regulations that are already on the books. In other words, under the Clinton administration, the decision was made to move forward on deregulation very rapidly, and under the Bush administration, the decision was made to simply avoid obeying the laws. So the net effect is the regulators did not regulate. There's no question about the fact that they have the capability to stop banks from getting involved in activities which are high risk in nature already.
But
they just didn't do it.
Right. But Richard Beauvais, the question that you raise right there kind of scares me. I mean, the same people who are responsible for that Clinton-era deregulation are mostly in the Obama administration. You got your Larry Summers, you got others, and they're going to take the initiative here? They, in some sense, led us into this.
Well, you know, in the South, we have something called come to Jesus meetings in which we basically bare our breasts. And in essence, I think what we're seeing on the part of the regulators is a recognition that the attitudes toward regulation have changed dramatically in the Congress and obviously at the presidential level. And therefore, they are now pressing on the banks relatively hard on all aspects of their business lines. And we are re-regulating.
All right, let's listen to one other thing that Elizabeth Warren said on the program yesterday, Richard Beauvais. Tell me what you think of this.
We desperately need reform. If we don't get reform, we're headed back into the boom and bust cycle game. And every, 10 to 15 years, we'll keep playing this game. And part of the world will get richer and richer, and the rest of us will continue to get wiped out.
She's basically describing the boom and bust cycle that prevailed from the 1790s right up to the Great Depression. She claims that regulation prevented that cycle during the 50 years after the Great Depression. Is she right? And if we don't go to Glass-Steagall, do we go back to the 15-year cycle?
Yeah, I think she is right that basically the changes in the laws, the Federal Reserve Act and the Glass-Steagall Act, were both very instrumental in eliminating a lot of the, if you will, wide swings in the economy that had occurred in the late 1800s. And therefore, I think that view is correct. But I don't think that we need any new regulations or new reforms because we already have more than enough to deal with whatever issue arises in the banking system. I think that if you consider the fact that you can remove managements of banks, you can cut their salaries, you can change their lending activities, you can stop acquisitions or divestitures, you can force a change in the structure of the organization, all of that can be done under the current regulation.
All
we
right.
don't need any more.
Well, let's imagine that Larry Summers was sitting right here, a chief economic advisor to Barack Obama. I mean, you're saying that we can essentially go back to Glass-Steagall with the laws that are on the books right now. Do you think that Larry Summers, all come-to-Jesus moments notwithstanding, is actually advocating that sort of thing, that he would say on this program, we're going back to Glass-Steagall?
Yeah, Larry Summers has already written, his view of what should be done, and he's asking for a significant increase in regulation, and I'm not sure he really understands what's on the books at the present time.
And does that make you optimistic or pessimistic?
Well, I think in the next couple of years, bank earnings are going to soar as a result of loan losses going down. So I don't think anybody's going to care that much right now as to whether we put the regulation on or not. But in 3 years from now, we will care.
Well, we'll certainly talk to you before then. Going back to Glass-Steagall, is that where we're headed? Bank earnings this morning from J.P. Morgan Chase are $3.3 billion. We may be talking to him earlier than that. Richard Beauvais, analyst with Rockdale Securities, a brokerage firm in Stamford, Connecticut, where he analyzes bank brokerage industries. Thanks so much. Coming up, a look at Prohibition 90 years later. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. Yesterday, we had a discussion about some technological innovations that could help in the relief efforts in Haiti. Doctors Without Borders has one of those technological innovations. It's an inflatable field hospital, and it's being deployed to Haiti today. We're joined now by Sophie Delaunay. She's the executive director of Doctors Without Borders here in the United States. Good morning, Sophie.
Good morning, Celeste.
Can you tell me how this inflatable field hospital looks, how it works, how big is it?
Well, it's quite big because the hospital we are sending has seven hospitalization tents and two surgical blocks. So you imagine that it's quite big, and it has necessitated us to find a flat piece of land in Port-au-Prince. And it has taken us several hours, actually, to find this place and be able to make sure that we would be in a capacity to set up this hospital. So it's quite big, and it is composed of all the necessary, you know, electronic, electrical, and sterilization material that we use to perform quality surgical care.
How many people can it accommodate, and how sophisticated is it? What kind of operations can you perform there?
I think that the hospitals that we have sent in Haiti are 100-bed hospitals, so they are quite big, and they are set up to perform, the kind of surgery that is needed in these specific circumstances, because Doctors Without Borders is operating in natural or man-made disasters, and we are conducting war surgery, rehabilitation, trauma care. All what is necessary to treat, you know, head injuries, fractures, crush limbs, amputation, etc.
You already have doctors there, and I read that you've treated more than 1,000 patients in tents over the past 2 days, and I assume there are thousands more that still need treatment. How do you go through the triage process? It's certainly a grim and terrible duty, but how do you do that?
Yes, it's extremely difficult to do that, but it's absolutely part of the job. We were able to treat a bit more than 1,500 patients over the past 2 days, since we already had 800 colleagues operating on the ground in three hospitals. And although our hospitals were damaged, we were able to set up some temporary shelters. But you're right, the first priority is to do triage, to identify the most serious cases and those we think that need immediate stabilization. But we've also been treating, you know, a lot of minor injuries and trying to maintain the most serious patients in stabilization until we were able to perform the surgery. The surgical activity has started yesterday, restarted yesterday, and we're gonna increase it in the hours to come.
And the inflatable field hospital lands somewhere near Port-au-Prince today. That's Sophie Delaunay. She's the executive director of Doctors Without Borders in the United States.
That's the
They've
best
treated
news
1,500 patients.
They got 800 people on the ground, three hospitals.
Well, we spoke with somebody else from Doctors Without Borders earlier, right, who said they didn't know how much they were going to be able to do since their hospitals were damaged, and that's how much they can do, 1,500 patients
More can
in 2 days.
You're on The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Thinking about the enormous experience of Prohibition 90 years after it began, I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. We're going to take a look at that in our last segment of the week coming up. But right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour in Haiti. After earlier reports that warehouses of the UN's World Food Program were ransacked, the UN now says they have recovered most of the food from their warehouses in the capital. Relief workers will begin distributing 6,000 tons of food aid soon. Relief workers have warned they may need more security, though, as Haitians grow increasingly desperate for help. One UN official says the main goal right now is getting food, water, and doctors out on the streets.
The local medical infrastructure is both badly damaged and overwhelmed by the number of injuries. So again, that's a top priority to get more doctors in there, more medical teams, field hospitals, more medical supplies.
Meanwhile, the U.S. ambassador to Haiti says the embassy is doing its best to check on the 40,000 Americans estimated to be in the country. About 450 Americans have been evacuated since Tuesday. The ambassador told NBC News that a steady stream of citizens have been looking for help to leave the country. And in other news today,
the Democrats may be days, perhaps hours, away from striking a final deal on health care legislation. The president and top Democrats met at the White House into the early morning hours last night, and they plan to meet again today. As many as 8 U.S. Army officers could be disciplined for not responding to the erratic behavior of the Fort Hood shooting suspect. The Pentagon is releasing the results of an inquiry into the shootings later today. And the moving to the skies, airline security is expected to get even tighter. That's after officials received a threat from Al-Qaeda in Yemen. Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano has told travelers to allow extra time for security, especially flying into the U.S. from overseas. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Drank 1925, Frank Crummett singing The Bootlegger's Daughter. Prohibition began 90 years ago today. It's almost impossible to imagine such a change taking place today. But 90 years ago, the 18th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution took effect. And like some bizarre digression, the basic law in the United States suddenly banned the manufacture and sale of alcohol. I mean, read the Constitution from top to bottom. It says nothing about booze, bootleggers, or moonshine. But the Prohibition movement had been a powerful force in American politics since 1810. It gathered momentum from women taking political power, outraged by what drunkenness had done to marriages and families. It culminated in that 18th Amendment, a radical change to American life that's almost impossible to contemplate today. Suddenly, a simple drink was a criminal act, and the ways people got around Prohibition were as real a part of America as teetotaling.
Now, this is where we take the orders for the booze. Now I'll show you what we make. This is the deluxe department. The boy here is making champagne. Tonight it will be delivered at the best circles. $15 a quart.
Is it real champagne?
No, it's diluted New Jersey Applejack.
It's kind of cheating, isn't it?
Cheating, yes. Cheating if you get caught. But you don't get caught if you take care of the right people. And this is big business. Very big business.
That's from the Roaring Twenties, a James Cagney and Priscilla Lane movie of the 1930s. Tom Fleming, historian and author of the new book, The Intimate Lives of Our Founding Fathers, is here in the studio to talk about what Prohibition's legacy is today, both politically and culturally. Thinking back 90 years today, Prohibition began. It was really a shocker to see that on the calendar. Welcome to the program, Tom Fleming.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here, John.
What do you think led to Prohibition? Because I can't imagine such a change, a constitutional amendment taking place today. And what do you think Prohibition's legacy is today?
What led to it was the success of the abolition movement. And the Prohibition Party, which was formed in 1869 as a separate political party, almost all of them were sons or actual workers in the abolition movement, which got rid of slavery. And they thought this was the next great movement, the great next great moral transformation of America. They were completely deluded about this, I'm sorry to say, but this was what was on their minds.
In many ways, did women lead the way on Prohibition?
They did. They really did. The most famous of them all was Carrie Nation. She was from Kansas, and Kansas was the first state in 1881 to vote itself completely dry. They had these local option laws, and towns could vote themselves dry, and then Kansas voted themselves dry as a state. And Carrie was already at work in Kansas with an axe. She'd charge into a saloon and smashed a place to smithereens.
And did she do this in public and get away
absolutely.
With it?
Oh, absolutely. And she got away with it almost all the time. And she had a legion of supporters, too. And this really appealed to women who wanted to do something to really have an impact, you know, and you could see why.
What did the rest of the world make of the U.S. attempts to morally cleanse itself through prohibition?
They were absolutely baffled and ironically amused, I guess you'd say. Even Canada, for instance, was really astonished. But they proceeded to take over a great many of the liquor industries that we had in this country and start running them up there. When I wrote this, article in the Wall Street Journal, I got a call from somebody who said, "I bet you don't know which president had a bootlegger father." And I said, "No, I really don't." He said, "Joe Kennedy."
Well, in many ways, that made the Kennedy fortune, prohibition.
It really did,
It made the political career of J. Edgar Hoover, who, of course, took over the enforcement of prohibition from the Department of the Treasury.
Right, yes.
It destroyed the reputation of Andrew Mellon, the Secretary of the Treasury, because he had interests in distilleries.
Right, right.
And listen to this voice, Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia in the 1920s.
Prohibition cannot be enforced for the simple reason that the majority of American people do not want it enforced and are resisting its enforcement.
So what led to the 21st Amendment, which was the biggest, I guess you might call it, never mind in history, which repealed prohibition?
There was a change in political parties. The Democrats came in, and the majority of, and certainly in New York, the majority of the voters were Irish Democrats. And
What are you saying there?
Exactly. What are you implying?
I'm implying that Irish like to drink. And they really felt this law was a direct blow at them. Woodrow Wilson had made a remark during World War I that ethnic Americans were pouring poison into the veins of American life. And this turned every Irishman in the country off about Wilson. So they tied it in with him. But once that legacy of the Democratic Party was swept away by 10, 15, 13 years of prohibition, they were ready to vote Democratic again, and that's how they got the majority to put Franklin D. Roosevelt in.
And bootleg and moonshine really did some medical damage. Pain was inflicted all over the United
States. Oh, absolutely. They were making absolutely lousy stuff that was poisoning people. But another thing was the economic damage. The federal government and state governments got $500 million a year in taxes from the liquor industry. It vanished.
Right.
And the liquor industry was the seventh largest industry in the United States. In fact, nobody knows this, but one of the biggest distillers in the country in the 18th century was George Washington. He had a big distillery at Mount Vernon.
Well, Tom Fleming is a historian and author of the new book, The Intimate Lives of the Founding Fathers, talking about 90 years ago, prohibition began. Thank you, Mr. Fleming.
Oh, you're welcome.
Speaking of, you were talking about some of this being really bad stuff. You know, my grandfather worked with W.C. Handy, the father of the blues, of the St. Louis Blues.
Sure.
He went blind drinking bathtub moonshine.
Moonshine, it's the subject of this song. Well, it's from our archives. Wow. 90 years ago, prohibition.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
It is.
It led to a colorful period of history, if nothing else.
Well, there's so many things that the reputations were made during prohibition. I mean, the Department of the Treasury used to enforce prohibition.
J. Edgar Hoover
at the FBI when it became part of the Department of Justice.
Absolutely.
You've also got the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. ATF is the remnant
and
of that old
And how can you get away
agency.
With all the names of the mafia that we all know so well? Simply because of prohibition. It was definitely a charter in our history that changed our course. But today we're asking you to imagine something else other than just historical times. We're trying to imagine for a moment that you are Conan O'Brien, and you're on your way out of the job, and you actually have a chance to say something to your bosses, and millions of people could hear it. We're asking you to give your shout out on the way out to the door. What would your exit monologue be?
Good evening, everybody. I'm Conan O'Brien, the new host of Last Call with Carson Daly.
Conan and Leno are all making jokes about NBC, their executives, their disgruntled current employees.
Right, and we had a caller, Jim from Westchester, gave us this.
I would say, boss, I would love to say that you've helped me grow both professionally and personally. However, I can't. The bottom line is you wear clown shoes. The only thing missing is a little squeezy nose, and I'm sure you've got the bozo wig in the closet at home.
I think Jim feels better. Jim feels better.
I bet he does.
Yes,
8778, my take of the takeaway.org, or leave a comment on our website, www.thetakeaway.org.
I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway. Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.